McGregor.
A hymn to music and a Russian fairy tale from two great Russian innovators, born a decade apart, each trying something new with the works we're about to hear. Alexander Scriabin was 27 when he began his first symphony in 1899, already a phenomenal pianist and successful keyboard composer looking for a new musical language. 10 years later, Igor Stravinsky, an admirer of Scriabin's, wrote the ballet that made him an overnight sensation, The Firebird. And we'll hear the complete work in the second half of this prom, played by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev. But while Firebird is a favourite score of Gergiev's, and Stravinsky's influence on 20th century music hardly needs elaborating, Scriabin is still another story, and Gergiev's keen that some of the limelight comes his way for a change.
I think First Symphony is a beautiful work of a genius composer who set for himself unbelievably difficult goals. He wanted to connect with other planets, to hear the sonority of universe, and to finally compose music which will be maybe heard as a voice of universe.
Valery Gergiev, and some of Scriabin's most exotic ideas and philosophies were still some way ahead when he wrote his first symphony. If you heard Scriabin's Reverie in yesterday's prom, then it seems to have triggered the symphony that came immediately after it, and which begins in an almost identical way, clarinet solo over shimmering strings. But it's already unconventional, this symphony. 6 movements, ending with 2 singers and a chorus, and Scriabin's own words, celebrating music's ability to exalt the human mind and inspire images of the divine. Now, this is being billed as the first prom's performance of Scriabin's Symphony No. 1, which is almost completely true. It's the first complete performance, certainly, but Henry Wood himself programmed the 4th movement alone in concerts in 1916 and 1921. And he also conducted Scriabin's Prometheus when the composer visited London in 1913. And when Scriabin returned here the following year, he seems to have noticed the infection on his upper lip that led to the blood poisoning that ended his life a year later. Some idea of Scriabin's fame and reputation can be gleaned from his funeral, which I've seen described as the most fashionable event in Moscow for years. Valery Gergiev's brought the soloists for tonight's performance with him from the Mariinsky Theatre in St. Petersburg. We're going to be joined by mezzo Nadezhda Sedyuk and tenor Sergei Skorohodov, and they're joined in their hymn to music in the last movement by the London Symphony Chorus. We're just waiting for the arrival of the London Symphony Orchestra's leader. Here he comes, Roman Simovich. And here come this evening's soloists, mezzo Nadezhda Sedyuk and tenor Sergei Skorohodov. And to conduct them in the Symphony No. 1 in E major by Alexander Scriabin, the LSO's principal conductor, Valery Gergiev.
Yeah. Thank you.
Glory to art, forever glory. The words of the chorus at the end of Alexander Scriabin's Symphony No. 1 from 1900. Which seems to have been met with something close to incomprehension by the first audiences at home in Moscow, although Scriabin might have been encouraged by something his fellow Muscovite student Rachmaninoff is supposed to have said. I used to think Scriabin a simple swine, but it appears that he's turned himself into a composer after all. Rachmaninoff denied the rumour. Well, you've just heard the first complete performance at the proms given by the London Symphony Orchestra and London Symphony Chorus, conducted by Valery Gergiev, who added to the mix this evening two soloists from the Mariinsky Theatre in St. Petersburg. And here they come, back onto the platform, alone this time, to the applause of the audience and chorus and London Symphony Orchestra. Mezzo Nadezhda Serdyuk and tenor Sergei Skorohodov. And back comes Gergiev with the chorus director, Joseph Cullen, and that cheer for the London Symphony Chorus themselves. The two soloists, like Scriabin and the composer we're going to hear in the second half, Stravinsky, one each from Moscow, the other St. Petersburg, and they both joined the Mariinsky Academy of Young Singers in the late 1990s, and have gone on to international careers since then while keeping close ties with Gergiev and the Mariinsky Theatre. The three of them now bowing to the promenaders on the front of the stage. And speaking to Valery Gergiev during this morning's rehearsal, he was keen to emphasize the influence that Scriabin had on Russian music in the 20th century, not just as a composer, but as a pianist as well. And he hopes that anyone listening to this evening's prom here at the Royal Albert Hall or at home who might have been attracted to it by Stravinsky's complete Firebird in the second half will have been encouraged by what we've just heard to explore further the music of Scriabin, one of the great Russian originals, and find out what happened next to his music. It's an interesting story. Back come our two soloists once again to acknowledge the cheers of the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall, followed by Gergiev and Joseph Cullen once again. And you can follow Scriabin's progress, if you like, here at the proms. He's one of the proms' featured composers. Scriabin's Poem of Ecstasy, which heralded his triumphant return to Moscow in 1909, is featured in this Friday's prom with the Philharmonia and Esa-Pekka Salonen. Some cheers for individual members of the London Symphony Orchestra for their solos. Bassoonist Rachel Goff, Gareth Davis, the principal flautist, and Gergiev shaking hands there with the orchestra's leader, Roman Simonich. Well, that first complete performance of Scriabin's first symphony, obviously very well received here at the Royal Albert Hall. And by the way, the Moscow performance of Scriabin's Poem of Ecstasy, which I just mentioned from 1909, coincided with the creation of the work we're going to be hearing in the second half of this evening's prom, Stravinsky's The Firebird, the complete ballet, and an exotic Russian fairy tale that surely shows in places the younger composer's admiration for Scriabin's music. At least in those days, he was loath to admit it later on in his career. But The Firebird is still some 20 minutes away, and right now it's over to Susan Hitch for the latest instalment of the Proms Literary Festival.
Hello and welcome to the Royal College of Music and this year's Proms Literary Festival. Tonight's music is Russian and 20th century, and we'll be talking about one of 20th century Russia's best-known writers, Boris Pasternak, who died 50 years ago this year. Actually, Pasternak might have appeared in the musical part of this evening if things had been different. One of this evening's composers, Scriabin, encouraged the young Pasternak to compose music himself. And he's best known here for his epic novel, Dr. Zhivago, made doubly famous by David Lean's film starring Julie Christie and Omar Sharif. In Russia, though, he's celebrated first and foremost as a great poet. We'll be talking to the writer, Jonathan Myerson, who recently adapted Dr. Zhivago for BBC Radio. It's a terrific adaptation. And Donald Rayfield, professor of Russian at Queen Mary College, University of London, who's written on Stalin and his secret police. And the actor, Adjoa Ando, who's fresh from Clint Eastwood's new film about Nelson Mandela, Invictus, will be reading us some of Pasternak's work. Please welcome them now. Pasternak's great novel, Dr. Zhivago, sweeps its hero, the young doctor, from Tsarist Russia and the First World War through the Russian Revolution and the Russian Civil War and into the Soviet Union as he finds and loses Lara, his great love. There's a lot of war and not much peace. Lara herself, seduced as a young woman by her mother's lover, Komarovsky, marries the idealistic student Pasha Antipov, who later becomes a Red Army general. Zhivago becomes a poet, and the novel is counterpointed by his, Pasternak's, poetry at the end. It's huge. It's a bit baggy. It's a great novel, but Jonathan, is it a good novel?
I think it's certainly greater than the sum of its parts. That's the way it works. There's something about it. I think if you read not any 50 pages, but, you know, an average 50 pages, you'd think, well, and yet somehow you get to the end and this extraordinary journey starts to make sense and pack a colossal emotional punch by the end.
And, Donald, I wondered whether a lot of it, the excitement about it in the first place, given that it is baggy, given that you really have to persist with it, people perhaps persisted with it originally partly because of the circumstances of its publication.
Oh, yes, because it came as a major scandal. It was refused publication. It was taken out of the Soviet Union by an Italian communist, Feltrinelli, and immediately translated into about 23 languages. And Pasternak was awarded the Nobel Prize, which the Soviets took as an insult and forced Pasternak to refuse it, and that in itself made Pasternak world famous. Ironic, considering that those in Russia who knew his work thought he was one of the major lyrical poets of the 20th century, and not all of them thought that his prose was comparable with his poetry.
Well, let's decide for ourselves by hearing a passage from the novel itself. Here, the young Dr. Zhivago has accidentally been thrown together with Lara, who's working as a nurse in an isolated village in wartime, Adjoa.
The sudden trembling of his voice revealed his rising agitation. Lara stopped ironing and gave him a grave, astonished look. It confused him, and he forgot what he was saying. After a moment of embarrassed silence, he rushed on, blurting out whatever came into his head. I have such a longing nowadays for an honest, productive life. I so much want to be a part of all this quickening, and then in the middle of all this general rejoicing, I come up against your puzzlingly sad, absent look, wandering in who knows what enchanted kingdom. I'd give anything for it not to be like that, for your face to tell me that you are all right, that you are pleased with life, that you don't need anything from anyone, for someone really close to you, your friend or husband, best of all if he were a soldier, to come and take me by the hand and tell me kindly to stop worrying about your fate and leave you alone. Only then, of course, I'd knock him down. Sorry, I didn't mean that. His voice betrayed him again. He shook his head and, with a feeling of hopeless embarrassment, got up and went to the window. Leaning on the windowsill, he looked out with absent, restless, unseeing eyes into the garden veiled in darkness and tried to collect himself.
Jonathan, why did you choose that passage?
It's so classically Russian. I mean, that I want to live a productive life, which goes back to Uncle Vanya and beyond, and you know, all those Russian novelists and poets. They all want to go off and do something productive and never do. And then there's that incredibly repressed emotion, which perhaps isn't exclusively Russian, but you know, they're clearly falling in love but don't dare say it to each other, and it's all rather hedged around, because actually that's the motor of Dr. Zhivago, the novel, is the repression of their emotion. And actually, in the book, Lara and Yuri Zhivago are only in the room for about 20 pages of about 500 pages. I can't remember. You know, it's stolen moments.
Is that right, Donald?
Yes. My problem with the novel is that characters don't talk to each other the way that characters talk to each other in other novels, and I think in life, and it's more like someone writing in a diary. A summary of what they said or composing in their minds what they're about to say. I think that's some of the weakest part of the novel. And as for the whole Lara love affair and the last relationship Yuri has with the daughter of a caretaker, I mean, this is a rather frivolous thing to say, but I'm reminded of what a Petersburg poet said about Pasternak. Now, Petersburg poets are never very polite about Moscow poets, that's true. But Anna Akhmatova admired Pasternak's poetry, but she didn't like his taste in women. And she said he can only be attracted by a woman if he sees her scrubbing the floor or doing the ironing. And this is precisely this. You notice that it's scrubbing floors, moving furniture, carrying buckets of water.
She said that before Shivago was
published?
Before,
yes.
Okay, that is prescient, yes, I agree.
Because Pasternak's second wife, he first saw scrubbing a floor. Okay. And that, to him, was ideal of femininity.
It's one of the things that David Lean changes a bit in his film, isn't it? I mean, that film made in 1965, it's Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's last great epic, liquid-eyed Omar Sharif, beautiful Julie Christie. She's made rather classy, not a floor scrubber, isn't she? I mean, it's unforgettable, but is it actually Pasternak?
Yeah, well, no, it isn't. David Lane is not Pasternak and Omar Sharif. Zhivago is supposed to be unattractive looker. He's got a sort of bent nose. He's not remarkable until he starts talking. Then his charm comes across, or is supposed to come across.
And does it for you?
Not for me. I mean, I will say frankly that to me that novel is a curate's egg. It's got 25 poems at the end, of which the first and the last are extraordinarily good, and many of the others are extraordinarily good. And it seems to me that one of the points of the novel is for Pasternak to become a poet again, that he has to invent a character who writes poetry, and then he can start. And if you look at his life, he has three periods in which he writes brilliant poetry. My Sister Life came out in 1922, after the Civil War and the Revolution, not a sign of the Civil War and Revolution. It's like supercharged Wordsworth. Wordsworth with a blanket and a woman next to him. Extraordinary rhythms, extraordinary inventiveness. Then in the 30s, after Mayakovsky's suicide, when you think nobody would want to write poetry after that, suddenly second birth, and poetry of extraordinary civic insight and other qualities. And then he becomes something of a Soviet poet until he invents Zhivago.
Jonathan, you have first-hand experience of adapting Dr. Zhivago for the radio. I very much admired your big six-part Dr. Zhivago, wonderfully spoken and wonderfully wonderful kind of range of voices you get into it. But how much do you actually lose? Do you take decisions about what you're going to give up when you're adapting?
Yes, and you try and sort of move over them quickly so that you don't feel the loss of them. You see, I'm going to go back on what Donald said about the dialogue isn't how people speak. Well, in my experience, that's how Russians speak. You know, you think you're talking about one thing and they're off with that theory about that. If there's any race on earth, you know, you think you're talking about the scrambled eggs, they're talking about your soul. You know, that's...
But the question of the relationship between the personal and political is one of those that great Russian novels, all of them, munch away at.
Oh, yes, and in Pasternak's case, he'd had the most appalling political experiences. He had, I would say, what we'd call survivor's guilt. The very fact that he was not arrested and not killed and not touched in the 1930s, when everyone else was, he just wondered why he'd got away with what he'd done. To me, I think the character of Zhivago is something that Pasternak wanted to be. He wanted to do good. He's a doctor, after all, and a poet. And above all, he dies before he's compromised. He has this death of which many Russians dreamt. Your aorta suddenly splitting apart. It's in Mandelstam's poetry. You wanted to die of that. Many people did after the starvation of the Civil War, so that you wouldn't be compromised by all the horror of the Great Terror when you had to sign petitions and cheer the party leaders. So Zhivago is in some ways an extension of what he would have liked to have been. And in that sense, it's a political novel. It's also about political evolution. It begins with worshipping revolution as a boy, as a student, and then coming to hate it and to see it as tyranny, which makes it, I think, politically a very, very interesting novel indeed and a very brave one.
And Zhivago is also a poet. You've already talked about how it does the remaking of Pasternak as a poet for him. Let's hear one of Pasternak's poems now. This one actually comes from the collection at the end of Dr. Zhivago, Adjoa.
Don't weep. Don't purse your lips. They're swollen. Don't press them any tighter. You'll tear open the scars of our springtime fitfulness. Lift your hand from my chest. We're taut-stretched cables. We're live. It's thrilling. Keep back, or it'll happen again. We'll tangle round each other, willing and unwilling. Imagine, years pass. You'll wed. You've forgotten these everyday struggles. A woman's life, it said, is a heroic step. It's wondrous. It's maddening. All the while, I stand simply, Facing the miracle of a woman's arms and neck, face and throat, I remain a house-born slave, always in awe, attendant, devoted. But no matter how fiercely this night shackles me, circles me, my pain, you'll always pull stronger. Your passion will tear us apart again.
That was the second half of a poem called Explanation in Jonathan's translation. Why did you choose that poem for us?
Well, I think because it also sums up the whole theme of Zhivago, that these two people who sort of almost can't dare to be together because it will end badly, as indeed it does. But I think also what it has is that it has overtones of that tremendous teenage intensity that you get in Russian writing, that they take on ideas like teenagers do. That it's like they took on Bolshevism. Oh, we've got to be Bolsheviks. The way, you know, a 17-year-old says, that is the only band worth listening to in the world. You know, they'll do that. And also the passion here. And actually, I made a deliberate reference to that. So the last line, your passion will tear us apart again, presumably is a valid translation of the original, but it's a deliberate reference to Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart Again. You know, it was that teenage intensity that everything is going to, almost as you were talking about aortas, you know, that wish fulfillment for death.
But Donald, what's Pasternak's reputation in Russia now?
I think that most Russians would say he is a very great poet, with my sister Life, Second Birth, the poems of Dr. Zhivago, and the poems he was able to write after Dr. Zhivago and the few years left to him in his own name. Of his prose, they'd say there's one wonderful piece, his autobiographical piece of prose called Safe Conduct, which is about his adoration for two poets quite unlike himself, the German poet Rilke and the Russian poet Mayakovsky. It's an extraordinary piece of prose, but most Russians that I know find Dr. Zhivago not a great work and a very difficult work to read. They'll say there are wonderful bits in it. If you want to know what it was like to be a schoolboy and a student in Moscow just before the revolution, if you want to know what it feels like to be freezing and starving during a revolution, then that will convey it better than any other. There are wonderful descriptions of nature. But there is a terrible problem with plotting. I think it's very well plotted in the sense the characters appear and they keep on coming back. But when you look at, say, the villain, Khabarovsky, who not only seduces Lara, causes the suicide of Zhivago's father, and what's more, when frustrated, he kicks his own pet bulldog. Now, that's going a little too far. He's so much a stage villain.
He's almost a proper Victorian. Villain. He's a proper villain.
Yes, I like him, but it's a fault in characterization, I think.
Let's return to Pasternak's poems. I wanted to hear one more of Pasternak's poems, which is his poem on the Nobel Prize, which he was awarded in 1958 and which he turned down, or tried to turn down, in order to be allowed to continue to live and work in Russia. Adjoa.
All is lost. I'm a beast in a pen. There are people and freedom outside, but the hunters are already at hand, and I haven't a way to take flight. The bank of a pond, woods at night, and the trunk of the pine lying bare. I am trapped and cut off on each side. Come what comes, I simply don't care. Am I a murderer, a villain, a creep? Of what crime do I stand here condemned? The whole world listens, ready to weep to my words of my beautiful land. Even now, at the edge of the tomb, I believe in the virtuous fate, and the spirit of goodness will soon overcome all the malice and hate.
That was Nobel Prize, translated by Andrei Neller. Jonathan, it's a poem about deep compromise, isn't it?
I can't imagine the frustration of that moment, that it's not only the Nobel Prize, but I tell you what I would have been thinking at that time. I would have been thinking, oh, no, that's my first draft they're publishing over there. You know, and that is the problem. You kind of wish that he'd had a chance to work with an editor on this book. I think it would have been hugely improved
with an editor, and you know, it's the poor man's first draft.
And there are a lot of Russian novelists, one feels, could have done with editors, and others would say the very way in which Russian writers used to be paid by the line, not on a percentage of sales, was a reason for many defects. I'd only say about that poem, there's an extraordinary parallel in the West, because when Nabokov wrote Lolita, and Lolita was condemned and banned, Nabokov wrote a poem in Russian on a very similar lines: what harm have I done with my little girl? Am I a paedophile? Am I exactly the same thought? Total puzzlement. And some of Pasternak's friends at the time said, you know, we sympathize, we know this novel had to be written, but you were very naive to think that you could get away with it.
But, and these are real questions, aren't they, Donald? I mean, I don't know what truth you think there is in it since, but some historians believe Pasternak actually to have been more radically compromised, to have been an agent of the KGB. I mean, in which case he would have been a murderer, villain, creep, as he questions in his poem.
I think that's a complete nonsense. There was no one, I think, who was less compromised than him. He had a way of talking which made it impossible for officials or secret policemen to get any sense out of him. They gave up. And they considered he was crazy. Even Stalin said, he lives in the clouds, leave him alone.
But that's all the more remarkable, considering there are some really rather good spy stories, at least CIA stories, around the publication.
Oh, yes, because the Soviets took their revenge not so much on Pasternak, but on the Italian publisher, Feltrinelli. Feltrinelli was a member of the Italian Communist Party, and the Russians forgot. The Soviets forgot that he was an Italian first and a communist second, and he went ahead and published, despite all the requests not to. He was found blown up with an electricity pile and compromising documents proving him to be a fascist. Yeah. Yes, that's where the spy stories come in.
Well, I was also told while researching it by someone whose father was on the literary estate where he had his house, that the word there was that the mistress was a KGB informer. But of course, what she would have been informing on, I don't know. This.
One of the things that impressed me about re-seeing the film, which, as we know, was not filmed in Russia. It couldn't have been. Mm. And the snow was fake. And it was nonetheless one of those moments which made me fall in love with Russian landscape, because actually it's very much a novel about landscape and that sense of place and that sense of vastness. Do you think that's Pasternak in particular?
I don't think a Russian writer can write without doing that. I mean, and then, you know, Lean and his designers picked it up in the film. I mean, it just is always there in Russian writing.
And Pasternak's very good at landscape. Yeah. His best poems are just landscapes, poems about the steppe. He's wonderful at landscapes. I can only think of one Russian writer who's hopeless at landscapes, never tried, that's Dostoevsky. I don't think there's a single tree in Dostoevsky.
Right.
A blade of grass, it's completely urban. But right. Every other writer, Turgenev, Tolstoy, Chekhov, they love landscape.
And those are the best bits in the novel. I mean, you know, like when Shivago is, walking back from the partisans to find Lara and that walk through there. Those are the bits that really come alive in the novel, and you think, this is what it takes.
Yeah, I agree with you, but those must have been the hardest to dramatise, landscape.
Oh, you just one line of narration, you're there. It's great.
I'm afraid that's where we have to leave it. Thank you very much to my guests, Jonathan Myerson and Donald Rayfield, to our reader, Adja Ando, and to all of you, our audience, here at the Royal College of Music, as well as to our listeners on Radio 3.
Susan Hitch was talking to the writer Jonathan Myerson and Donald Rayfield, Professor of Russian at Queen Mary University of London. The reader was Adja Ando, and the programme was produced by Natalie Steed. And just across the way from the Royal College of Music, here in the Royal Albert Hall, this evening's prom continues live on BBC Radio 3 with the second part of our concert celebrating two Russian innovators, Scriabin and Stravinsky. We're about to hear the work that made the younger man's name, Stravinsky's ballet The Firebird, whose Paris premiere in 1910 created a sensation. A century later, it's still a huge draw, as the London Symphony Orchestra and its principal conductor Valery Gergiev are proving this evening. And perhaps it's not too fanciful to suggest that Scriabin's sensuously exotic orchestral writing found a way into Stravinsky's first ballet in the music depicting the Firebird itself. But as Valery Gergiev was keen to point out to me earlier, it's really Rimsky-Korsakov's fingerprints that are all over the Firebird. Rimsky set his pupil orchestration exercises based on his latest operas, which were being prepared for the Mariinsky Theatre. We're going to hear the complete ballet score, and not just one of the suites from it, and that matters a great deal to Valery Gergiev.
The whole score tells the story. You tell the story where the suite brings the brilliant elements in a compact form of 20-something minutes, and you can really excite audiences with the suite. But if you want to follow the story, and if orchestra has these colors, and if I may say, understanding of the theatricality of the score, because you cannot play this score as an objective, instrumental writing. It's just technical brilliancy to be displayed. So conductor has to inspire orchestra in a way that everyone becomes, if needed, a dancer, if needed, a very monstrous creature, if needed, a very young and very elegant girl who moves on stage, or this famous dance of Firebird. I mean, you have to really imagine how it can be staged in the theater on stage, how it can look. So when you have an idea, it maybe also sound better. That's how I think. And yes, I have experience to conduct this score in the theater. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And we even keep historical production for Kin. And of course, they are wonderful traditions we at the Mariinsky don't want to remove.
Valery Gergiev, and Stravinsky's connections with the Mariinsky Theatre are stronger than you might realise, not just through the famous productions of his works that they preserve, like this one, or through the operas of his teacher Rimsky-Korsakov, but through his own father, Fyodor Stravinsky. He was a principal bass baritone at the Mariinsky Opera, and the family lived in a flat just around the corner from the theatre in St. Petersburg, until Stravinsky was married, and the Firebird flew him to France for that fairy tale success. And what of the fairy tale itself? It was actually the choice of Serge Diaghilev, who chose the story before he decided on the composer who'd write the music for his dance company, the Ballet Russe. In the garden of the demon king Kashchei the Immortal, the Firebird appears, chased by Prince Ivan, who catches her and only releases her in exchange for a magic feather. 13 princesses come out of Kashchei's castle and play with the golden apples from an enchanted tree until Ivan appears and falls for the most beautiful princess. Dawn is breaking and the girls have to return, and as Ivan tries to follow, Kashchei's monsters seize him, and Kashchei himself tries to bewitch the prince. But Ivan has the magic feather and summons the Firebird, whose own magic makes Kashchei's followers dance themselves to exhaustion. And as they sleep, the Firebird shows Ivan the egg which contains Kashchei's soul. The prince smashes it. Kashchei dies, his magical creatures vanish, and all his captives are released. Ivan and the most beautiful princess are married amidst general rejoicing. Well, Stravinsky was an unknown outside Russia at the time, although by the time Diaghilev thought he'd try him out for the Ballet Russe, Stravinsky had already had two early orchestral works performed, the Scherzo Fantastique and his Fireworks. And it seems to have been the St. Petersburg performance of the Scherzo in 1909 that made Diaghilev's ears prick up. He must have been delighted with the results of his gamble on this young composer. Stravinsky's score, Bakst's designs, and Fokine's choreography made for an intoxicating Firebird in Paris, conducted by Gabriel Pierney, with one of the critics acclaiming the most exquisite marvel of equilibrium that we've ever imagined between sounds, movements, and forms. Stravinsky, though, rather turned against the Firebird later on. Its international popularity meant that there were constant requests to conduct and perform it when he'd rather have been conducting other things. And here comes Valery Gergiev to conduct Stravinsky's The Firebird, a century after its Paris premiere in June 1910.
Thank you. Thank you.
And they all lived happily ever after. General rejoicing at Prince Ivan's wedding to his princess and the freedom of Kashchei's captives at the end of The Firebird by Igor Stravinsky. Which may have been begun rather nervously at the behest of Serge Diaghilev for his Ballet Russe, but which made Stravinsky an overnight sensation in Paris after the first performance 100 years ago. And what a reception for this evening's conductor. Here he comes, Valery Gergiev. We've just heard Firebird as he thinks it should be heard, complete. The only way to get a full sense of the story, he says, brought so colourfully to life here in the Royal Albert Hall by the players of the London Symphony Orchestra, including the offstage element that's required for the complete Firebird. Wagner tubas, three trumpets and percussion. The trumpets reappearing at the back of the stage to add their weight and colour to that final blaze of triumph. Well, we know what happened next for Stravinsky. The next two great Russian ballets for Diaghilev, Petrushka in 1911, then the scandalous success of The Rite of Spring, whose pagan ritual incensed and entranced audiences in Paris in 1913. And you'll be able to experience it for yourself at the Proms later this season. And here come the calls for the individual members of the LSO. That one for bassoonist Rachel Goff. Oboist Emmanuel Aboul. Baronetist Andrew Mariner there. And flautist Gareth Davis. Shouldn't forget the piccolo playing with Sharon Williams. There's the whole of the heavy brass, the trombones and tuba on their feet. And I think we must have missed David Pyatt, the principal horn player, when Gergiev first came on. Some superb playing from all of them. Gergiev shakes hands with principal viola player Paul Silverthorne, cellist Timothy Hugh, and now the LSO's leader, Roman Simovic. The whole orchestra on its feet now. It's the LSO's only prom this season, Gergiev's second and last. And next he's taking the LSO to perform Mahler's Fifth Symphony in Gestalt before joining up with his Mariinsky Orchestra for performances in Vienna and Stockholm, and then comes his own festival in Rotterdam, I think. And there are more opportunities to unpick the various threads of late 19th and 20th century Russian music this week. Stravinsky's teacher, Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, alongside Tchaikovsky's Second Symphony on Thursday. And tomorrow evening at the Proms, a key Soviet symphony by someone who represents to some the opposite of Scriabin's influence in Russian music, Dmitri Shostakovich. His Fifth Symphony from the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Edward Gardner. Russian violinist Alina Ibrahimova joins them for the world premiere of a new violin concerto by Hugh Watkins, and there's music by Arvo Pärt and Benjamin Britten in the first half. That's live here on BBC Radio 3 from 7 tomorrow. But here in the Royal Albert Hall tonight, the cheers are continuing. Even if Kashchei's spells have been broken, the enchantment cast by Stravinsky's Firebird has started stretching into its second century. And back in his own magic kingdom in Broadcasting House, here's Jonathan Swain.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. Andrew McGregor there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, as well as the BBC iPlayer for listening again, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom broadcast in its entirety again next Monday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 at 2 o'clock. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then why not go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, back to this evening, and in a couple of minutes' time, the Lebrecht interview tonight. Norman Lebrecht talking to the American mezzo Joyce DiDonato, famous for her Rossini and Handel, and also for her engaging powers of communication, singing and talking ones. That's at 9:45 or just after. And after it at 10:30 tonight's I beg your pardon, tomorrow night's prom soloist, the violinist Alina Ibragimova, tonight playing Bach, one of the unaccompanied violin sonatas. Alina's one of the many international stars to have graduated from the BBC Radio 3 New Generation Artists scheme. Her father, by the way, Renat, is principal double bass player with the London Symphony Orchestra, who we've just been listening to. Old French song from Tchaikovsky's album for the young. The pianist there was Victoria Postnikova. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10:15. And now time for the Norman Lebrecht interview.
Joyce DiDonato is one of those singers who, riding high in an opera career, suddenly explodes into mass fame by a freak combination of fate and her own fortitude. In Joyce's case, she broke a leg last year in the first act of Rossini's Barbara of Seville at the Royal Opera House in London. But instead of being ambulanced to hospital, she insisted on staying on, singing out the opening night with the help of a stick and a crutch, and she then returned in a pink cast and wheelchair to perform the rest of the run. Such courage and determination is rare in a profession where two sneezes can be cause for cancellation. Over the years since her accident, DiDonato has won celebrity as a real heroine rather than a stage one. The sixth child in an Irish Catholic family in Prairie Village, Kansas, she married young and was almost 30 before anyone was prepared to back her. In the decades since then, she's taken on mezzo roles in Rossini and Handel with a wide-eyed zest that audiences find irresistible, an openness that appears to be innate. She writes a chatty, cheerful blog and decorates it with photographs that she snaps wherever she goes. She's the very model of a 21st century communicator. We meet in Milan, where she's singing tonight in the Barbara of Seville. Joyce DiDonato, you seem so natural on stage, almost to the manner born.
Oh, well, I feel very much at home on this stage. It's a place that I love to be, and I have found that it's an incredible teacher to me. So I welcome the chance to be on there. I suppose I welcome the chance to play the fool every once in a while. And
you show a lot of yourself, though, on stage, in role. You do seem to be wide open.
I do, but I think I've learned that. I had a natural ability to go out on stage and impress as an actress, but it wasn't always real. It was sometimes done in a very showy way.
From what age?
High school. Mm-hmm. I loved being on the stage. It was only, I think, by actually doing this a lot and being on my own and wanting to be better that I was able to start peeling away some of the layers around me and, I think, become a more honest performer, where I wasn't trying to impress so much and make a big impression, but really trying to find the truth of the character and let more of myself show through. But that's been a process, and I think it will continue, I hope.
And you felt that being on stage was the most of you, that this actually brought you out of yourself, out of your shell, out of being the prairie girl?
Yes. A few years ago, after 9/11, I remember in particular, I think everybody's world shifted a little bit at that time, and I realized the only place I really felt alive and free was on the stage. And I had just enough comprehension of the world of the theater and opera to know that that was an explosively dangerous thing, because it would become more and more of a drug. It would be the only place that I found any kind of contentment or happiness. And I thought, whoa, I do not want this for my life. And I would say I was, you know, maybe 32, 33 at the time, my early 30s when all of this process was going through. And I made a very, very distinct decision that I had to do the work in my life to find that freedom and happiness in my life, because ultimately that's what lasts, hopefully. But that's why I say the stage has been a teacher, because it showed me the kind of freedom that was possible in myself, freedom of myself and expression. And I used that as a beacon to try and help me find that in my day-to-day life. And it's a work in progress, you know, as my life on the stage is as well. But I think I backed off of that cliff of the stage being the only thing in my life that provided release. And now I can go to it with a different kind of freedom. I don't need the stage the way I did back then. For me, it's a gift. I come and it's just simply a place to express and live and enjoy life, but it's not the only place that I have that.
Because you have happiness and balance in your life.
That's what I work for, yeah.
Prairie Village, Kansas. Is it as it sounds?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it really is sort of a small town. What it is it's a suburb of the metropolitan Kansas City area. And it's, you know, a lot of sort of cookie cutter houses, and all the lawns are kept very well. When I was growing up, it was very middle class neighborhood. And, you know, we were sort of on the lower end of the middle class there growing up. But, you know, our church and my school was a block away. The grocery store was another block in the other direction. Everything was central right around there. So it was a village in that sense. But the prairie part, thankfully, was not too much in existence. It was a real functioning suburb.
But you're 1,000 miles from any ocean, any sea.
Yes.
You're really in the middle of America, about as middle as it's possible to be.
Completely. And it's an ocean of land, not of water, where we were.
Did you ever feel trapped inland? Did you ever feel as a child a need to get away from that, to get out?
I think, you know, growing up, no, it's what I knew. It was normal for me. But when I went to college, at Wichita, Kansas, which was even more in the middle of Kansas than Kansas City is. And it's really in the middle of nowhere. I went to college to be a teacher. And so my path was very clear. I was very certain I would be a high school music teacher. I would probably move back to Kansas City and teach in a local, probably Catholic high school. That was my certain future at that point. And I got sidetracked into this opera thing. And through that world, all of a sudden, my kaleidoscope just really, really opened up. And I started doing a few competitions outside the state of Kansas. I took a trip to New York City to study with a very famous teacher for 2 lessons. And really, it was as if the blinder just flew off and I went, oh, there's a whole world out here. There's different kinds of people. And even the world of opera itself, with these stories and the librettos and the world that was created around these operas, my life really exploded, I think.
And your home is still in Kansas?
My home is still Kansas City. It's the buckle of the Bible Belt.
And when did you last see your home?
I'm trying to remember. I think it was January. A friend of mine is a blogger, and she asked me to do a guest interview on her blog, and it was about travel in this business. And she said, last year, how many days did you spend at home? And I counted it up. It was 32 days in my home. And it was not consecutive, I will say. It was sometimes 2 days or 3 days dropping off luggage and doing laundry. I think the longest span was 6 or 7 days, but I was home for 32 days. That's crazy.
Sounds like things are going well.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
When you struck out into the big world, Wichita State University, Philadelphia Academy of Vocal Arts, it was a big step. Did you feel like the girl from Hicksville?
I completely felt like the girl from Hicksville. And every so often, I still do, actually. But now I can laugh at it and not apologize for it. I was overwhelmed moving to Philadelphia. I was married at the time.
You married very young, while you were at college?
Yeah, well, we met, my first husband, we met my freshman year in college. It's a very Midwestern thing, you know, and we dated all through college. And like everybody else, we got married that first summer. I think I was 22.
Oh, I've seen the movie.
Yeah, haven't we?
Many times.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, he is a wonderful person.
And an Italian?
American.
American-Italian,
but
right.
With Italian
right.
And
ancestors.
And musician? No, big sports guy and a travel agent, actually, and is really, really one of the most wonderful human beings I've ever met. But I think I didn't have a clue who I was. I think he did, actually. He has always been a very secure person in who he was, but I didn't know anything. I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't really know what was important to me, who I was. You know, all those things at 22, you're certain that you do know at that time, of course. And so, you know, things just sort of played out in a way that I didn't expect them to. But I had to sort of follow where I was going and the way I was evolving as a person. But we moved to Philadelphia with no money. At AVA at that time, your tuition was paid for, which was quite an extraordinary thing because we had coachings every day, voice lessons every week. You know, I mean, it was at that time a $30,000 tuition. But we had to pay for our living. There were no stipends or anything. So I was working as a choir director and as a waitress at the same time going to the academy full time. It was quite a bohemian existence. Mm. Yeah. I was thrust into this crazy, intense, competitive world, and it took me a few years to get my footing there. It was a very tough experience, psychologically in particular, because it was a very grueling training. And at the time, I didn't understand it. I look back on it now, and it's the best thing that probably could have happened to me, because constantly I had to keep deciding, do I really want to go for this? And do I think I have something to offer? Because I was not necessarily built up in that place. I was the Kate Pinkerton, and I was the lover in Il Tabarro. You know, I didn't really get a... I sang Adora Bello there, which was lovely. But I had to really, really fight because nobody was really my champion there. I had to find something in myself that gave me the will to keep going and to keep trying, even if it wasn't a sure thing, because I was not the golden child there.
And what was that something? Because you were also fighting your own self-doubt.
Absolutely. And not to be diminished, my vocal technique. I didn't really know how to sing yet. I was going sort of on instinct and crossing my fingers that the high notes would come, and often they didn't. But I had something in me that I thought merited the attention. I had a really strong desire to communicate. I had a really, really strong desire to sing this music. And I also felt I had all of this inside of me, but nobody was seeing it. Nobody was getting it. I was like, well, I've got that inside of me. Why didn't I win the competition? Or why didn't they give me that role? And I thought, well, it's obviously stuck inside of me. It's not being communicated to the people that need to get it. So I kept working, and I kept searching, and I kept working, and I kept searching, and I kept working. And I think that has been a quality that has served me really well, because I'm not afraid of work. And I know that even now, you know, I have a good resume, I've got work coming for the next couple of years, I'm in a good place, but the work isn't finished. And I know that that's been a quality that has served me really well.
Is that a kind of faith? A sense of destiny?
Sometimes I think so.
That you were made for this?
Yes. Sometimes I do feel like I just have to step back and say, I'm doing what I'm meant to be doing.
And who's telling you this?
I think the bottom line for me is that it's myself, because when I'm in the groove and when I am really doing the work, and it can be in a rehearsal, it can be at a piano by myself, it can be in front of the Milanese public at La Scala, or it can be at a private charity concert in a living room somewhere, it's easy. And that doesn't mean the work is easy and that the singing is easy. It just means there's a flow to it. And that tells me that I'm not fighting a losing battle and I'm not fighting obstacles that are being thrown at me. And I think when somebody, you know, you watch a great sports person, I love sports and there's so many parallels to what we do, but you watch Federer hit a tennis ball and you just know there's a lot of work behind what he does, but it's easy. He's exactly where he's supposed to be. So I feel that for myself. But also the important thing as a performer is I feel that also from the audience. If the audience didn't get what I was doing, it would tell me probably that I'm also not in the right field. And not everybody gets me or loves my singing, and that's fine. We're in a very subjective category. But at the end of the day, you know, people write me, or the applause at the end is rather heartfelt and overwhelming. And that tells me that I'm touching them in some way, or the music via my vocal cords is touching them. And so if I didn't feel that that element was there as well, I would walk away.
That's very well put. I don't think Federer could have put it better. Houston Grand Opera, that was your first job, wasn't it? And the voice teacher, Steve Smith, told you to forget everything you'd learned and start again from scratch.
Yes.
That must have been tough.
It was.
It's pretty brutal as well.
Well, at the same time, it was so frightening and scary. On the equal side of that, it was so liberating. I was 26 when I started that program. And at that time, a lot of my colleagues who were 24, 25, 26, 27 were already getting covers at the Met, singing starring roles at City Opera, having management, you know, winning competitions. And I was starting to feel a bit behind. But I also knew, again, going back, I had all this expressive desire, but I didn't have the technique and I could feel that. So I thought, he's found me out. He found out that I don't know what I'm doing. Come to find out, I think I was much more the rule than the exception. I think there are very few 25 or 26-year-olds that really know what they're doing. And we see that. We see these people shoot out of the gate and 28, 29, 30 hits and they start falling apart. And sadly, we've seen some very high-profile cases of that and it's heartbreaking. Because if you're in the thick of things, how do you take time off and fix a problem? For me, the first lesson, the exact quote he told me is, he'd vocalized me for about 4 minutes on some ahs. And he said, look, I'm direct. And come to find out, that's a quality I think I appreciate more than anything. Because in this business, who has time to be lied to? Oh, you sound great. That was fabulous. And you're like, thank you very much. And you know people are lying to you. You know, I'd rather have the straight story. Why didn't I get the job? Why did I get a bad review? Tell me what I need to work on. And then I can be proactive about it. So the fact that he was so direct with me, I think, shocked me at first. And then I thought, oh, well, now we can actually work. So he said, Joyce, you're musical. I think you're intelligent, talented, but there's no future in what you're doing. You are singing on youth and muscle, and that's going to last you about another 4 years. And the load that went off my shoulders was huge because I thought, oh my God, he knows I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I would cross my fingers and stick them behind my back going through my passaggio, hoping I could manage it, you know. And he said, if you trust me, we can do this. I said, okay. And from that first lesson, I to this day told him I feel like I got completely naked in front of him because he took away all the tricks that I was using to sing. My tongue was like iron and my jaw had to be set to just create this sound and push out, try and get the buzz going. And he took all of that away from me. And it took a full year for me to let go of that muscle memory. A full year. So we took a year stripping everything away. And that second year that I was with him, he started really replacing it with the breath. And then I was out of the studio, but I stayed in Houston for a third year so that I could continue working with him. And I think I needed that last year to start trusting everything we had built up. So for me, it was an absolute three-year, full-on intensive project. And now I get to see him maybe twice a year. But the foundation that we laid was so strong that I've been able to carry that technique with me through these years.
And that was just the beginning of people telling you that you couldn't do it. There was the competition judge in London who said, this contender has nothing to offer as an artist.
Yeah, that was a big moment. And he's since gone on the record saying that he thinks I misunderstood what he said, that that wasn't exactly what he intended to say.
I think we can name him. It was Graham Johnson.
Graham Johnson, yeah. Yes. He was the head of the panel, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I will say that he has contested the way that I phrased this and that he did like my audition and things, but there were some things missing. And, you know, I don't bear him any ill will at all. And ultimately, what he said or didn't say, or what any judge or audition panel said or didn't say, ultimately what matters is what I took from that experience. My impression from that was, okay, they think I have nothing to say. So there must be an element of truth in that. Why would they say that? I had to ask that question. I mean, it was a couple weeks of crying, and okay, I was bitter at the beginning. But then, you know, then time goes on and you learn. And I really am not bitter in a way, whether he said it or not. In a way, it was the greatest gift that could have come to me, because I said, well, I'll be damned if anybody's ever going to be able to say that about me again. And I had to look inside myself. And in essence, you know, I think there was a lot of truth to it, because I arrived, I was probably 28 at the time of this competition, and I was acting like an opera singer. I mean, the hand was on the piano, my posture was just so, the hair was just done up just perfectly. I was well coached, and everything was spot on exactly as it should be. And I couldn't understand why I didn't win. You know, and instead, I was sort of regurgitating and presenting a well-coached product instead of letting myself shine through. This goes back to the first question that you asked me about peeling away the layers and letting myself be vulnerable on the stage, which means being open to criticism and failing and missing a note and, you know, not being liked by everybody. But I'd rather do it as myself than sort of acting like a diva or putting on a persona.
7 New York agents turned you down.
Yeah, if not 8, yeah. They know who they are.
And
it's funny, some of them now will come up and go, gosh, I can't believe I didn't get it. It's like, oh, well, everything works out.
And you'd missed out on Placido Domingo's Operalia competition in 1998, but it was there that Simon Goldstone, a London agent, heard you and took you on, and then took you on an endless round of auditions, and 12 times more you were turned down.
Exactly.
You've really been round the track.
I've paid my dues, I think, yeah.
How do you cope with all that rejection? Before you're even started, everybody is slamming the door. How do you cope with that? I mean, were you having therapy? Were you seeing someone? Where was that strength coming from?
Well, again, maybe my naivete, my ignorance, my blissful ignorance. I did these 13 auditions in 16 days. I'll never forget it. It was December, too. And it was Glasgow, Scotland, to Seville, to Antwerp, back to London for E&O, Nancy. You know, it was good company, sort of mid-level. And they all gave me very polite rejections. Yes, we think she's interesting, but we have nothing to offer her. We don't have anything to, we'll keep an eye on her. And I didn't have any other choice other than to keep going, because my plane tickets were already booked and I had already prepaid the hotel. So I just kind of continued on with the tour. And Simon had prepared me at the beginning. He said, look, if we get one or two offers out of this, that's great. So I wasn't expecting, you know, 12 offers, but one would have been nice. So I was quite low, I have to say. And my last audition was for the Paris Opera. And I was tired, I was broke, my back hurt from dealing with my luggage and all these planes and everything. And I think I sang the same audition. Maybe I cared a little bit less, because I was like, you know, if Nancy didn't hire me, like Paris really will. And 2 hours later, I had an offer for the new production of The Barber of Seville. And like that, my fortune changed.
And during all this time, you're also having to cope with the breakdown of your marriage and 9/11, and your parents are in poor health.
Yeah,
and dying.
That was spread out over a little bit of time. 9/11, breakdown of my marriage was sort of tied up together. And I think those were the formative years that I really had to make some decisions for myself. I, for a long time, was the good Midwestern Catholic girl that was doing everything I thought I should be doing. And I felt like I was living somebody else's life according to other people's standards and other people's expectations of me. And I think somewhere in those years, my early 30s, I finally said, you know what? This is going to get really exhausting trying to please, you know, the people in my family or stay in this marriage that I don't think is the right thing for me anymore, which was not at all an easy realization or easy. It was immensely painful. Finally, I think got my feet on the ground for myself, deciding to follow my own life and start owning it. I actually realized one day it's quite ungrateful of me to downplay what I do. You know, who knows how long this will last? The vocal cords, you know, the voice is quite a precarious thing. Tastes can change in the opera world. If I don't enjoy it now, my God, I want to make sure I'm enjoying it now and owning it as the person that I am. Happily, I think I got my feet pretty firmly on the ground when my parents' health really went south, and I lost them both within the period of 5 months, which was a big shift. It was a big shift for my life, an indescribable loss that surprised me because I was a very independent child. I didn't rely on my parents for money or, you know, I didn't go to them when I had a big decision to make. You know, I was very independent, and boy, I was proud of that. And I think I pointed that out to them on every occasion that I could, that I didn't need them. So the sense of being an orphan suddenly really, really surprised me.
What did success feel like after all of that? You wake up in the morning and there's somebody knocking on your door. The hotel is probably still a 4-star. And they bring you the newspapers and the headlines say A Star Is Born. What did that feel like?
Well, it's wonderful. It's amazing. And I continue to pinch myself that I'm the recipient of that.
A lot of people can't cope with it. A lot of people have breakdowns when the success finally comes.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Give me time. No. You know, I think part of it is I have a very self-deprecating attitude towards things. I know that this success, I can finally admit that the success has been born out of a lot of the work that I have done. I also think that I have a pretty clear picture of what the success means. You know, as quickly as it comes, it can go away. And certainly the next Rosina is coming up behind me and the next Octavian. As you know, I have been a successor to other people. I know that I'm a part of a link, a chain link, and I'm just one link. And I will have my moment, and then that moment goes to somebody else, and I'll go on to the next phase of my life. And I work pretty hard at trying to keep it in balance and in perspective. And at the same time, I make sure that I'm enjoying it. I make sure that with this perspective and this knowledge that it's probably a temporary thing, I want to enjoy it. And I want to go out and relish, you know, the audience has paid tickets to see me and to hear me. I think that's a cool thing. And, you know, I never want to give less than my best, which, you know, some nights will be better than others, but at least that night I've done my best.
Rossini, your bedrock composer, was never totally box office. Marilyn Horne, talking to me recently in this series, said it took an American to show the world in her time that he was a great composer. You've sort of extended that line, haven't you? There was Marilyn Horne and now there's Joyce DiDonato.
Oh, wow, that's lovely. I love that she says something like that. I just love it. Sometimes I downplay everything that I do and then you hear a diva like that say something. I just think, good for her. Leontine Price one time told me, I said, Miss Price, you know, do you still listen to your recordings? And she said, oh, my darling, sometimes I, you know, pop open a bottle of champagne and I just revel. I loved my voice, you know, and you just think, that's fabulous. I love it. You know, there is no mistaking the legacy that Marilyn Horne left and the road that she forged, the Semiramides, the Tancredi, Italiana. You know, I think Barber was always in the repertoire, but she was able to pull out these other real rarities at the time. And you see the audiences in these wonderful YouTube videos, and they're all just there with their mouth open, like, what are we hearing? And it's an extraordinary gift that she gave the world. And she was, of course, in this time, you know, with Caballé and Sutherland, and they could just explode into this world of bel canto. And I'm very much aware that I'm reaping the benefits of that. And, you know, right now I think we have this plethora of Handel singers and Rossini singers. I'm sorry for the Verdi lovers. You know, everybody says, where are the Verdi baritones? Where are the Verdi sopranos? You know, these things go in cycles. But I'm very happy that I'm living in the day that I am today. You know, with, gosh, the tenors that are out here right now to sing, you know, Larry Brownlee and Juan Diego Flores and John Osborne. I mean, so many wonderful Rossini tenors that we can really sort of revel in this wonderful music.